This program is provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim.
Right now, on electronics assembly line in Nanchang, there are 8 humanoid robots pulling a 64-hour continuous shift.
Yeah, and no coffee breaks for them.
Exactly. No breaks, no sleep. And they are sorting manufactured parts with, it is, a 99.99% accuracy rate.
It's honestly wild to even picture that.
It is. But, you know, the most important thing about these robots isn't actually their titanium joints or, like, their battery life. Mm. It's the invisible, highly restricted digital border that's actively being built around their brains.
Which means we are totally witnessing the end of an era. I mean, for the last few years, the global conversation has been entirely focused on creation, right?
Yeah, like who can build the biggest AI model?
Exactly. Who gets the highest benchmark score? Who can release the most open source tech? But that chaotic open science fair phase, it's over. We are now entering the era of control.
Well, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today, we're taking you through a really comprehensive briefing and commentary provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim, a former lawmaker.
And this material is just gold for anyone trying to understand the current landscape.
It really is, because if you're the kind of person who wants to cut through the daily tech hype to find the real paradigm shifts, this is for you.
Yeah.
This material offers an incredibly rare, holistic look at a massive pivot happening globally, specifically driven by China's sudden shift from aggressive AI expansion to strict strategic lockdown.
Yeah, and what makes lawyer Kyung-jin Kim's analysis so valuable is that it doesn't just treat AI, robotics, semiconductors, and telecom as like separate, isolated industries.
Right. It maps them out as one giant interconnected geopolitical machine.
Exactly. When you look at the entire board, you realize that governments aren't just regulating a software product anymore. They're stepping in to manage the physical deployment, the hardware bottlenecks, and this is the craziest part, even the emotional impact of these technologies.
Yeah, AI is basically being locked down as a strategic national asset. So let's look at how these borders are closing, starting with the software side. The briefing highlights that Chinese authorities are currently discussing restricting overseas access to their large AI models.
Which is huge news.
Massive. We're talking about heavy hitters from Alibaba, ByteDance, and ZAI. And this really caught my attention because, well, China's primary strategy over the past year was the exact opposite.
Yeah, they were everywhere.
Right. They were flooding the global market with these low-cost, open-weight models like DeepSeek, Qian, and Kimi. Mm-hmm. They were essentially handing out their tech to developers worldwide.
Like a much cheaper alternative to American models, basically.
Exactly. So, okay, let's unpack this for a second. If the weights, like the mathematical variables that actually make the neural network function, if they are already downloaded on a developer's server in Berlin or Brazil, how do they actually pull that back? I mean, you can't just remotely delete them, right?
No, you definitely can't. You don't claw back the past. What you do is you choke off the future.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the existing released weights are out in the wild. But a foundational AI model isn't a static piece of software you just buy once on a CD-ROM.
Right, it's not the 90s anymore.
Exactly. It's a continuous pipeline. The unreleased next-generation models, the real-time API access, the enterprise-grade deployment tools, those are all controlled at the source.
So they just cut off the updates?
Essentially, yes. If a foreign developer wants to keep their application running with the latest updates, they're suddenly going to face entirely new barriers.
What kind of barriers are we talking about in practice? Like, how does a government enforce that?
Well, according to the commentary, it involves deployment reviews, regional access restrictions, and strict investment qualification checks.
Wait, investment checks? For an API?
Yeah. An investment qualification check means the provider, acting under state guidelines, will actually look at a foreign company's corporate structure. They'll look at their funding sources, their geographic location, all before granting an enterprise access key. So if your startup doesn't align with their strategic interests, your API access is simply revoked. The model is no longer treated as a commercial service. It's a restricted export material.
Which creates a massive supply chain risk for any global company that built their infrastructure on those cheap models.
Absolutely.
But, you know, to be impartial here, it's not just a one-way street. The U.S. is dealing with its own severe leakage problem right now.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. The Financial Times reported that cutting-edge models from OpenAI and Google have been quietly flowing into the overseas subsidiaries of blacklisted Chinese companies.
Yeah, that report was really eye-opening. Singapore has basically emerged as a major routing hub for this exact kind of activity.
How does that work exactly?
Well, a blacklisted tech firm in Beijing obviously can't buy a direct enterprise license from OpenAI.
Right, they're a block.
But their legally distinct subsidiary in Singapore, that subsidiary might just rent cloud computing space that happens to include access to those exact models.
So it's a loophole.
A huge one. Both superpowers are waking up to the fact that these digital borders are incredibly porous. The U.S. is scrambling to enforce export controls and plug outbound leaks, while China is simultaneously trying to prevent unauthorized inbound access and also keep their own tech from being used freely abroad.
It's a total mess. Yeah. And software leaks are notoriously difficult to plug because, I mean, it's just data moving over a wire.
Exactly.
But hardware is a physical object. If software is the water, hardware is the plumbing. And lawyer Kung-Jin Kim's commentary makes a really fascinating point about where the actual physical bottleneck is located right now.
Yeah, this is a crucial shift to understand.
We hear endless talk about compute chips,
right?
Like the GPUs that do all the heavy mathematical lifting.
Mm.
But the real choke point shifting the geopolitical balance is actually memory.
Yes.
So why is memory suddenly the Achilles heel of AI?
Well, think about it like this. Computing power without massive memory capacity is like having a genius-level intellect but suffering from severe short-term amnesia.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Thanks. When an AI model generates an answer, what we call the inference phase, it isn't just doing math. It has to hold enormous amounts of data, like entire context windows and its active memory all at once.
Right. So if it can't hold that information,
the whole thing crashes, or at least slows to a crawl. If the memory chips can't feed data to the compute processor fast enough, the entire system bottlenecks. The incredibly expensive GPU just sits there idle, waiting for the data to arrive.
Wow. Okay. That perfectly explains the sudden focus on CXMT that the briefing mentions.
Exactly.
So for those who don't know, CXMT is a Chinese manufacturer of DRAM, which is dynamic random access memory. And according to the material we have, CXMT is now being considered for Apple's testing supply chain for devices specifically sold in China.
Which is a huge milestone for them.
Right. If memory is the ultimate choke point, getting a domestic memory manufacturer up to Apple's exacting standards feels like a massive strategic shift.
It fundamentally rewrites the supply chain calculus. You see, when we talk about China's vulnerability to hardware sanctions, the focus is almost always on advanced computing chips from companies like NVIDIA.
Sure.
But a compute chip can't operate in a vacuum. The historical weak link for China has been advanced memory, advanced packaging, and server integration. If CXMT can produce memory reliable enough for a major global supply chain like Apple, China effectively closes that loop.
So they essentially build a self-sufficient ecosystem.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You take domestic computing chips like Huawei's Ascend series, you pair them with CXMT memory, and you run them on domestic Chinese servers using domestic operating tools.
And suddenly the sanctions don't hurt as much.
Right. The impact of external hardware sanctions is heavily diluted because the core components are no longer reliant on foreign imports.
And the global financial markets are clearly recognizing this shift. Just look at SK Hynix.
Oh, yeah. The Korean memory giant.
Right, a major South Korean player that heavily dominates the high bandwidth memory market. Back on July 10th, their American depositary receipts, which is basically just a mechanism that allows U.S. investors to buy shares in foreign companies, those receipts jumped 12.8% on their NASDAQ debut.
That is a staggering jump for a company that size.
Right, and we are even seeing leveraged ETFs being built around these memory manufacturers.
Yeah.
A nearly 13% jump on a debut is just wild.
Yeah,
it suggests
yeah.
The market views these memory chips as far more than just standard computer components.
Absolutely. Investors now understand that top-tier memory chips are dual-purpose assets. They are highly speculative financial instruments, yes, but they are also critical geopolitical tools.
It's a whole new ballgame.
It really is. But, you know, this creates a very volatile split reality for global chipmakers. Well, SK Hynix might see surging demand and massive profits in the U.S. market as American companies scale their data centers. However, as China builds out its sanction-resistant loop with domestic memory makers like CXMT, those same global companies are going to face intense pricing pressure and shifting supply chains inside the Chinese market.
Right, because they don't need the foreign chips as much anymore.
Exactly. The global semiconductor market is actively fracturing into two distinct ecosystems.
Man, So we have the brains, the software models, and the memory chips getting locked down inside these new digital and physical borders. But, you know, a brain needs a body to interact with the physical world.
This is where it gets really fun.
Right. If you want to see where this hardware actually ends up, we have to look back at that Longcheer factory in Nanchang, the Agibot G2 demonstration.
Yeah, this event completely changes the metrics of success for the robotics industry.
The numbers are just staggering. Like we mentioned at the start, over a 64-hour continuous live stream, 8 humanoid robots operated on an active electronics assembly line.
And they weren't just standing there looking cool.
No. They executed 64,828 specific tasks. Visual inspection, defect sorting, moving materials around during the production of over 17,000 tablets. And they achieved that 99.99% success rate.
It's mind-blowing.
It is. And here's where it gets really interesting to me. We are so used to seeing humanoid robots doing, like, backflips or dancing to pop music at tech expos.
All right, the flashy demo videos.
Exactly. But this wasn't a show. This was a blue-collar worker pulling a 64-hour shift on an actual assembly line. They were testing for pure, grueling endurance.
Because the true battleground for humanoid robotics is not the living room. It really isn't.
I don't think so.
No, it's not about building a consumer robot to fold your laundry right now. The real deployment happens in semi-closed environments. Think logistics centers, power plants, customs facilities, and obviously mass production floors.
That makes total sense.
A factory manager does not care if a robot can mimic human gymnastics. They care about continuous uptime. Can it run for 64 hours without breaking down? Can it inspect a microchip for defects with microscopic accuracy?
And they proved it can.
Yes. And, most importantly, can it integrate seamlessly with the factory's existing software?
Okay, let's talk about that integration because lawyer Kung Jing Kim mentions two specific systems in the briefing, ERP and MES, Enterprise Resource Planning and Manufacturing Execution Systems. How do these actually interact with a physical robot on the floor? But that sounds super complicated.
It is, but let's break it down. Think of the ERP as the factory's overarching brain. It handles the high-level business logic.
Like what?
Like the incoming orders, the supply chain inventory, the shipping schedule, all the big picture stuff.
Got it.
Then you have the MES. The MES is like the orchestra conductor standing down on the actual factory floor. The MES tells every single machine what to build, at what speed, and in what sequence, literally down to the second.
So if the humanoid robot can't read the conductor's sheet music,
it is completely useless. It becomes a very expensive piece of titanium just standing in the way of production.
Right.
The Agibot demonstration proved that these robots can plug directly into that MES layer. They receive real-time instructions, execute the physical sorting, and then report the data back to the central system without any friction.
Wow.
And honestly, the first company to master that deep software integration at scale is the one that captures the actual revenue of industrial automation.
But that level of integration, I mean, that requires a flawless nervous system, right? If a robot is receiving commands from the MES to inspect a tablet screen, and there is even like a fraction of a second of network lag, the whole assembly line backs up.
Oh, entirely. Which brings telecom directly into the center of the AI arms race.
Yeah. Telecommunications is basically the invisible connective tissue making that factory floor possible.
Exactly.
And the shift in how telecom is viewed was incredibly obvious at the World Artificial Intelligence Conference, WAIC 2026, over in Shanghai.
Oh, that host list was something else.
All right. Just look at who was hosting it. You have the National Development and Reform Commission, the Ministry of Industry and Information Technology, the Ministry of Science, the Cyberspace Administration of China, and the Shanghai City government.
It's basically the Avengers of Chinese regulation and industry policy all sitting at the same table.
Having all of those agencies co-host this event is like having the Federal Reserve, the SEC, and the Department of Defense in the U.S. suddenly sit down to write one unified policy. It signals that telecommunications is no longer just a civilian utility. It is a core matter of industrial policy and national security.
Yeah. In the past, those sectors were completely siloed. You had telecom conferences, AI summits, and government policy panels. By unifying them, the message is super clear. They are now functioning as one giant organism.
So what does that mean for the telecom companies themselves?
It requires a total identity shift. The era of focusing entirely on consumer 5G, you know, bombarding people with ads about downloading movies to their phones faster, that's effectively over.
The strategic value has shifted. Telcos are transforming from traditional network providers into AI infrastructure operators.
So lawyer Kunjin Kim specifically points to edge data centers and 5GA or 5G advanced private networks. Let's dig into the mechanics there for a second. Why do these factory robots specifically need a 5G advanced private network? Why can't a smart factory just use standard 5G or even just really good industrial Wi-Fi?
It really comes down to latency and uplink capacity.
Okay.
Standard Wi-Fi is highly prone to interference, especially in a metal-heavy factory. And standard consumer 5G is built for downlink, meaning pushing data to your phone.
Right, like streaming a video.
Exactly. But a robot inspecting a tablet for microscopic defects needs to send high-resolution video up to the network to be analyzed by an AI.
Ah, so it needs a massive pipe going the other way.
Yes, that requires massive uplink capacity. Furthermore, if you send that video to a centralized cloud server 50 miles away, the round-trip time for the AI to analyze it and send back the accept or reject command takes too long. Latency literally kills factory efficiency.
So edge data centers solve the distance problem.
Precisely. An edge data center is essentially a mini server farm physically located on or just immediately adjacent to the factory property.
Oh, so it doesn't have to travel far at all.
Right. You pair that local computing power with a 5G advanced private network, which offers ultra-low deterministic latency. The computation happens locally. The robot's brain is essentially offloaded into the factory walls, and the 5GA network acts as the hyperfast optic nerve connecting the robot's physical cameras to the local server.
The telecom network effectively becomes the robot.
That's a great way to put it.
That completely redefines the business model. I mean, if you're a telecom executive anywhere in the world, investing capital purely in consumer cell towers is a dead end for growth.
Mm-hmm.
You have to bundle edge computing, industrial networks, and robot control systems to remain relevant in the next decade.
It is a total architectural pivot from serving humans to serving machines.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most profound shift outlined in lawyer Kunjin Kim's commentary. We've explored how AI interacts with factory ecosystems and how it rides on these advanced telecom nervous systems. But the Chinese government is aggressively stepping into a far more intimate space.
Yeah, this part is wild.
They're regulating how AI interacts with the human mind.
And honestly, we spend a vast amount of time analyzing industrial productivity, but the regulation of anthropomorphic AI, which is AI designed to act and sound human, is arguably just as critical to a society's stability.
I totally agree. So the Cyberspace Administration of China, the CH, implemented new rules taking effect on July 15th, 2026, regarding AI anthropomorphic interaction services. And the details here are absolutely fascinating because they target the psychology of the user.
Right.
The explicit goal is to prevent emotional dependence and addiction. They are outright banning virtual relatives and virtual lovers for minors. And for adults, there's a mandatory reality check mechanism.
This is the part that really blew my mind.
Same. If a user interacts with an AI for more than 2 continuous hours, the system is legally required to break character and remind the user that they are talking to a machine.
Furthermore, when ending the service, the provider is legally required to allow the user to completely copy or delete their emotional interaction data.
This flips the entire Western conversation around AI safety on its head. When we talk about AI safety, it is almost always framed around catastrophic physical events, right?
Yeah, like, will the AI hack the power grid? Will it launch a weapon?
Exactly. We focus on a sci-fi Terminator scenario. But this regulation is focused entirely on psychological safety. It's about preventing the movie Her. They're regulating the emotional supply chain.
The emotional supply chain is the perfect way to conceptualize it. AI companion apps, elderly care robots, interactive children's toys, they are intentionally engineered to simulate empathy.
Yeah, they want you to feel connected to them.
Right. They are designed to make the human user form a parasocial bond. And from a regulatory standpoint, a deeply bonded user is an easily manipulated user.
So how does a global company navigate this practically? Let's say you're building a sophisticated voice assistant in Europe, and you want to use Chinese hardware components, or base your system on a Chinese open weight model. Or perhaps you just want to sell your product into that market.
You have to fundamentally overhaul your product design. You have to build that 2-hour circuit breaker directly into the code.
Wow.
You need robust, verifiable age gating to ensure minors aren't accessing virtual companions. China is essentially establishing the first comprehensive legal precedent for the psychology of human-AI interaction.
That's a huge deal.
If your business model relies on maximizing user engagement by simulating endless unconditional affection, these regulations actively cap your growth by forcing you to routinely shatter the illusion.
It is an incredible engineering constraint to consider. You're building a product specifically meant to simulate human friendship. and you are legally required to hard-code a kill switch into the relationship.
Yeah, every 2 hours, the machine must enforce a detachment.
Mm.
Remember, I am just code on a server.
It ensures the emotional leverage remains with the human user, not with the corporation or the state running the model.
Which brings us full circle to the core thesis of lawyer Kunjin Kim's commentary.
It really does. Pulling all of these threads together, the overarching message from the briefing is that we have to move beyond just looking at the technical benchmarks. We have to stop obsessing over parameter counts and start analyzing this great migration of control.
Because the transition is happening simultaneously across every single layer of the technology stack. We're watching physical robots move off the tech expo stage and onto the demanding reality of the factory floor, requiring deep integration with industrial software.
Right.
We are watching semiconductors shift from a pure race for processing speed to a scramble for holistic, sanction-proof supply chain dominance, with memory becoming the critical bottleneck.
Yeah.
We're seeing telecom providers abandon consumer networks to become the central nervous systems for edge computing.
And we are watching AI models transition from a philosophy of open global distribution to being hoarded as highly restricted, heavily regulated national assets. The digital walls are going up everywhere, and they're being reinforced with concrete policy.
Which leaves us with a rather profound geopolitical and honestly psychological question to consider for the listener.
What's the question?
Well, if nations are now actively building these massive legal walls, not just around the physical hardware and the deployment of AI, but around the very emotional bonds we form with it, what happens next?
Okay.
Imagine a near future where a citizen in one country develops a deep economic reliance, or worse, a profound emotional reliance on an AI entity that is entirely controlled, monitored, and regulated by a rival nation. In a world where AI is undeniably a strategic asset, is human attention and even human affection the next heavily sanctioned resource?
Wow. Embargoes on digital affection. That is a massive thought to chew on, and it really reframes how we interact with the technology in our pockets right now. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We started by talking about borders. The physical walls might define our geography, but these new digital, silicon, and emotional walls are going to define our reality. Keep your eyes open, keep questioning the rapid shifts happening right under your nose, and we'll see you next time.
This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.